With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. Hillary's wake leaves huge losses for table grape growers. California table grape growers in Kern and Tulare County suffered major crop losses last month when Tropical Storm Hillary slammed vineyards as they neared the peak of harvest season. With about a third of the crop harvested before the storm hit, California Table Grape Commission estimated the wind and rain damaged 35% of the grapes that remained on the vines, around 25 million boxes. The boxes hold about 21 pounds of grapes each. Western Ag Crop Insurance Services, which surveyed the damage to table grape crops, said more than 60 million boxes may have been destroyed. That was today's California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News Report, and now let's get into today's show headlines. Farm Bill, Spending Bills, and Impacts on Ag Issues. The government's fiscal year ends September 30th, and Congress either needs to pass a full-year spending measure for the next fiscal year or at least an extension of the current one. If not, the country faces a shutdown and its effects of the future of the 2023 Farm Bill. Hot-button issues include U.S. border control with Mexico, how to use money not spent on COVID programs, and borrowing authority for the government. For agriculture, the concern is not only the crafting of the 2023 Farm Bill, but what the fate of the Farm Bill-funded programs look like with this pending government shutdown. National Milk Producers Federation Vice President of Member Services and Governance, Chris Galen, says,
some of the programs in the 2018 Farm Bill begin to expire at the end of September. Most of them, including a lot of the dairy safety net ones, expire at the end of this calendar year. And so unless they pass either a new farm bill or get an extension of current policy, we could also be looking at the expiration of some key farm programs here in the coming months.
Also at issue is modernizing the Federal Milk Marketing Order, which is currently undergoing a USDA hearing in Indiana.
The funding for that hearing, the judge that's overseeing it, the renting of space in Indianapolis where the hearing's taking place, that would all come to a screeching halt. So this talk about government shutdown and the impacts on various industries, this is just one little example, but it's a real world one for us in the dairy industry, is that this hearing that's been going on would come to a halt for however long it takes to get more funding for USDA in the future.
NAFB contributed to that report, and now here's Brian German with more Ag News.
Many producers are not optimizing the use of livestock waste as fertilizer. Account manager agronomist with Verdesian, J.W. Lemon, said there's some considerations that can often be overlooked when using manure as a nitrogen source.
We put it on and it's almost a crapshoot. You put it on and it's like, well, I might get 5 pounds this time, I might get 8 pounds next time. I might get real hot stuff one occasion, and it's so fickle that it adjusts with the weather. If you're in California and they're scraping or flushing and then they're tossing the material into a pile to dry out before they go spread it or something, 10 days of triple-digit weather can completely change the whole complexity of the waste that you're putting on there through volatilization, through ammonia gassing off. In that heat, we're losing a lot of the nitrogen that should have been put on the field to grow better crops.
The Central Coast Rangeland Coalition will be hosting its Fall 2023 workshop in Santa Cruz County. The workshop will take place at two different locations on Thursday, October 19th, beginning at the Scotts Valley Community Center. There will be a panel discussion going over rangeland insurance and specific examples of ranch lease insurance requirements, challenges, and solutions. There will also be a presentation on connecting housing to rangeland stewardship, followed by an orientation on the Glenwood Preserve and the Land Trust of Santa Cruz County. After a small group discussion and lunch, attendees will make their way to the second location at the Glenwood Open Space Preserve. Presentations will highlight the work taking place with a grazing lessee to conserve habitat for the Olone tiger beetle and other special status species. More information about the workshops available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
GMOs? Genetically engineered? Bioengineered? What's what? Well, GMO stands for genetically modified organism. It's the common term many people use for foods created through a process scientists call genetic engineering. And you'll start seeing bioengineered on some food packages to let you know the product or some of its ingredients come from GMOs. Feed your mind with more GMO knowledge on FDA's website.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, now that California's Prop 12 is in effect, hog producers around the nation are having to decide if they're going to change their operations to comply. National Pork Producers Council President Scott Hayes says it's an individual choice and one his family farm turned down.
So it's totally a producer's choice whether they produce for that market or not. There's a lot of uncertainty around that market. You know, we've been advocates for producer choice, which we think provides consumer choice. I can't speak for all the producers in Iowa, but I know myself personally, I've chose not to make that change because, you know, if you think about it from a producer perspective, you know, most of the cost is borne by the producer. There's a little bit of cost and segregation, you know, after it leaves the farm, but most of the cost is up to the producer. So, and the only revenue from that, it comes directly from the consumer. They're going to have to pay more. We don't know yet whether they're going to be willing to do that. And even if they do, that consumer dollar then has to pass from the retailer down through a couple of two or three channels before it gets back to the producer. And for my family, we're just not willing to bet the farm that all that's going to happen.
He says he's hopeful House Agriculture Committee Chairman Glenn G.T. Thompson can follow through on his comments on using the 2023 Farm Bill to address the rule.
Congressman Thompson knows a lot more about it than we do. We're certainly hopeful that there'll be some fix. Congressman Thompson's been a champion of producers' rights and consumers' rights, and he certainly wants to prevent you know, the elitist in California from telling the rest of us how to raise pigs. And as Brian said, it goes far beyond that. That's just the beginning. I think if you dig into the Supreme Court ruling, what it said was even the Supreme Court finds this is a problem. It just wasn't, they didn't think it was their problem. And they encouraged Congress to fix this. So, you know, we would echo that, you know, we believe that Congress needs to fix this. We understand it's a complicated issue when you start talking about all of commerce between states. But we do need a fix, and we very much appreciate Congressman Thompson being champion of trying to get this resolved.
National Pork Producer Council President-elect Lori Stevemer says California shouldn't be making all the rules.
All right. I would just jump in and say, I mean, the frustrating part about Prop 12 all along is that California is telling other producers what to do. And I've said it before, as a Minnesota pork producer, I don't think California should tell me how to raise pigs. In terms of adapting housing practices, I mean, producers have been doing that all along, right? If they wanted to raise pigs outdoors, they can raise pigs outdoors. If they want to be inside, they can be inside. The market determines that. The incentives they might receive from their packer processors determines that. So that hasn't changed at all. That free market part, the part that's frustrating is that, yes, one state telling another what to do or telling others.
According to the California rule, as of July 1st, producers must comply with Prop 12 regulations. Now, pork that was already in cold storage before that July 1st deadline can still be sold in the state until the end of the year. That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, this week, milk advocates made presentations before a dietary guidelines committee, stressing dairy's unique nutritional benefits to a committee holding informational gatherings to prepare for the next set of guidelines. The National Milk Producers Federation's Regulatory Affairs Director, Miguela Hanselman, along with Olympic athlete and former member of the Dairy Farmers of America Cooperative, L. St. Pierre, told the government's Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee how dairy is a critical component of diet that should be considered in light of its full range of benefits in comments made before the panel. St. Pierre is a world medalist track athlete who represented the U.S. in the women's 1500-meter race back in 2021 Tokyo Olympics. She and Hanselman both offered their perspectives on dairy's role in diet before the panel that will shape the scientific report informing the 2025 to 2030 Dietary Guidelines for Americans. Both hold degrees in nutrition and public health. Hanselman's comments focused heavily on how the dairy at all fat levels benefits diverse communities and how current guidelines work against including varieties of milk that Americans consume the most. She noted, with the scientific question focused on sources of saturated fats, this committee has the opportunity to remedy a previous oversight and include the newer science on dairy fats and the dairy matrix. She said dairy foods, regardless of fat level, appear to have either neutral or beneficial effects on chronic disease risk, including cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, obesity, and stroke. St. Pierre, a recent new mom, spoke out against the proliferation of plant-based imitation beverages that offer widely inconsistent nutritional value, cautioning against any consideration of them as a potential dairy replacement. She noted plant-based beverages are so nutritionally different from real milk that whether one views them positively or negatively, their impact on health cannot be assumed to be the same as or even similar to that of milk. Now, the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee is convened every 5 years by the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Health and Human Services in order to make recommendations for Americans' diets affecting numerous federal nutrition programs. And the National Pork Producers Council has been tracking discussions this week during a meeting being held in Thailand. Representatives of the countries in the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework for Prosperity are meeting, and MPPC continues to urge the Biden administration to raise unwarranted food safety, animal health, and technical barriers that some IPEF countries have that limit market access for U.S. pork. MPPC notes that U.S. pork producers rely heavily on exports, shipping over 25% of last year's total production worth nearly $7.7 billion to foreign destinations. The IPEF countries represent about 1.5 billion consumers and 40% of the world's GDP. MPPC raised with the administration's trade negotiation the non-tariff barriers of several IPEF countries. To learn more about this, go to their website, nppc.org. I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water. Your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
Shining a spotlight on innovative startups in ag. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. The American Farm Bureau Federation, in partnership with Farm Credit, is shining a spotlight on startup companies focused on advancing agricultural innovation. They've selected the top 10 teams in the 2024 Farm Bureau Ag Innovation Challenge. The competition provides an opportunity for individuals to showcase ideas and business innovations in agriculture. This is the 10th year of the challenge, which was the first national business competition focused exclusively on rural entrepreneurs launching agricultural and food-related businesses. Farm Bureau is offering $165,000 in startup funds throughout the course of the competition. The 10 semifinalist teams will compete at the AFBF convention on Friday, January 19th, to advance to the final round, where the four finalist teams will receive an additional $5,000. You can see who those top 10 finalist teams are on our website, agnetwest.com. I'm Sabrina Halverson for Agnet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McGowan. The Corporate Transparency Act takes effect on January 1, 2024. At that time, businesses formed on or after that date must file a report within 30 days of receiving notice that the creation of the business is effective. If your business was already in effect, then you have until January 1 of 2025 to file a report. What is this all about? And is your farming operation required to file a report? Under the Corporate Transparency Act, in the near future, any business entity that must file with the state is required to register with the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network. Entities that own real estate are included among the entities that must file, but certain farm entities are exempt. There's actually a long list of entities that are exempt. Included in that list are entities that employ more than 20 people, operate at a physical office in the U.S., and file federal tax returns that show more than $5 million in gross receipts or sales. So smaller entities are not exempt. This means that many farming operations won't have to file a report, but an exempt entity might have other entities that will have to file. This could be an equipment LLC, a land LLC, or any other related entity. Simply having one large farm entity will not exempt other related entities. Just something that smaller farming operations will have to deal with in the future. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCullough.
Consumers, as you purchase fruits, vegetables, tree nuts, horticultural plants, you may not realize the examples in front of you as provided by support mechanism for the nation's specialty crop industry and its growers. The Agriculture Department Specialty Block Grant Program has been around since 2006. And as Agriculture Undersecretary for Marketing and Regulatory Programs Jenny Moffitt explains, marketing is a part of the program's purpose.
The program works in partnership with state and territory departments of agriculture. So these 55 partner state and territory departments of agriculture administer the program in partnership with the Agricultural Marketing Services. They develop a plan for how they want to administer the program in their state, but the program can support things like marketing, education, and research to enhance the competitiveness of specialty crops.
So what do these specialty crop block grant program efforts look like on the ground level? The Undersecretary provides examples from projects from within recently awarded grants to states and territories, funding in total of almost $73 million. For instance,
another award is through the state of Alabama, and it's about expanding the fan base of Alabama specialty crop at university football games. So they'll do things like inviting football fans to sample seasonal specialty crops at tailgate settings, marketing specialty crops at the stadium with advertisements, really working at six Alabama universities during the 2024 football season to increase consumer awareness and willingness to purchase Alabama specialty crops by promoting the industry in really high traffic outlets.
Meanwhile, a project in Georgia
is an innovative online marketing tool to drive consumers to purchase Georgia Grown. Georgia Grown is a branded program in Georgia where producers who grow in Georgia can apply to be certified and under the Georgia Grown label. So what they're doing there is they're increasing the recognition of that Georgia Grown label. So if you're in Georgia and you're looking to buy Georgia Grown, consumers will be able to have more recognition of that label. That should also help with consumers as well as producers and connecting the two of them as they're looking at these different types of more local market products.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
You're listening to Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
Bottom line analysts wonder, how low is low in the grain trade? How much higher can livestock futures climb? I'm Mark Oppel with your bottom line report, brought to you by Helena and Kloss Equipment. Refuel your farm equipment for free thanks to Kloss. That's if you win $10,000 worth of free farm diesel. To register, go to fuel.kloss.com. Well, looking at planted acres and harvested acres figures from Tuesday, that along with the usual harvest pressure, bottom line analysts wondering where solid support now might show up. To be as helpful as we can with all the lingering questions, we would see December corn slipping another dime from here, and November soybeans, for that matter, at least another dime lower from here into tomorrow and next week. December, Kansas City wheat tried to hold lows around $7, and we think that they can. Helena says improve your fertilizer efficiency and increase your yield potential for next season right now. Products like Resurge. Visit HelenaAgra.com to learn more. This is the bottom line report. October live cattle finding 185 a tough level to get through, and it should be contract highs from mid-July, 185.75. And October live hogs above 85 and a quarter would finally break them out of a recent range. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day.
He says he's not willing to bet the farm on a California rule. Now that California's Prop 12 is in effect, hog producers around the nation are having to decide if they're going to change their operations to comply. National Pork Producers Council President Scott Hayes says it's an individual choice and one his family turned down.
Most of the cost is borne by the producer. There's a little bit of cost and segregation, you know, after it leaves the farm, but most of the cost is up to the producer. And the only revenue from that, it comes directly from the consumer. They're going to have to pay more. We don't know yet whether they're going to be willing to do that. And even if they do, that consumer dollar then has to pass from the retailer down through a couple of two or three channels before it gets back to the producer. And for my family, we're just not willing to bet the farm that all that's going to happen.
I am Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Good day, everybody. Albert J. Hernandez, the Untamed Chef for AgNet West. Welcome to the California Kitchen, where you can learn how to cook from an award-winning chef in under 3 minutes or less. I'm your host with the most. Let's get untamed. I've been getting a lot of requests on Instagram, Facebook, and emails on how to make really great chicken. So here is that recipe for all of you incredible fans and followers of what we're doing here on the California Kitchen. So starting off first, we're going to be doing some free-range chicken breasts. And by free-range, I also mean air-chilled. We don't want any chicken that's been compromised or been frozen. It is important to have air chilled because it's going to have a better texture. And if you don't believe me, trust me, the details are in great, great ingredients. Now what I'm going to be doing is I'm going to be seasoning this with salt and pepper. And I always put my salt and pepper on the skin side first. And I want to be able to see that salt and pepper. When I always say to taste, capital T, that means it's always a preference. However, I want it to be a certain way. So I want to make sure the salt and pepper is on that chicken breast and I want to be able to see it because that tells me that I know it's on there. I'm going to flip it over and I'm going to do the exact same thing. Now I have four people in my family, so I'm going to do this times four. I'm also going to add to this our Cajun spice as well as our dehydrated garlic. And last but definitely not least, I am also going to add to this some chives. This is so, so important because we're going to have some really, really great flavors. Now I'm going to put my skillet on a medium-high heat. Once that skillet goes on that medium-high heat, what I'm going to do next is I am going to put it into the pan and I'm going to let it sit skin side down for 2 minutes. All I'm adding to that pan too is just 1.5 tablespoons of vegetable oil. I'm going to flip it over. Once I flip it over, I'm going to add now to this 1/4 tablespoon of butter. And I'm going to start the basting process. I'm going to bring that butter to a nice heat and we're going to baste the chicken with that. My oven should have already been preheated to 325 degrees. And I'll have a pan ready that once all the chickens have been basted, they're going to go into this pan and they're going to go into the oven at 325 degrees for approximately 8 minutes. This is going to make sure that our chicken hits an internal temperature of 165 degrees. And by the time it comes off of that skillet after being basted, it should be about 155, 160. So it's only carrying over 5 degrees, which is going to make sure that your chicken is juicy and absolutely delicious. Now, it is important, once the chicken comes out, to let it rest for about 5 minutes before slicing it and cutting into it, so we can make sure that all the juices go back to the center and it doesn't make a mess on your plate. For this and many tips, tricks, and all things Untamed, go to www.ajhtheuntamedchef.com. And as always, this is Albert J., the Untamed Chef for AgNet West.
It started back when this man was president.
The moment is at hand to put an end to hunger.
And this song was a number one hit.
Sing us a song, you're the piano man.
The date?
September 17th, 1973.
USDA Outlook Board Chairman Mark Chekanowski says that was when the USDA's World Ag Supply and Demand Estimates Report, the WASD, was first released to the public. And he says it's been pretty much a monthly happening ever since. Now, in case you're unfamiliar with WASD, it's a report issued monthly with USDA's updated forecast for U.S. and foreign crop and livestock production, supplies, domestic use, exports, and prices. And actually, the report's older than 50 years old. Mark says USDA produced that report for years.
But it was just an internal USDA report.
But obviously that changed in September of 1973, brought on by several circumstances.
Markets really started to become very volatile, perhaps largely reflecting the huge grain purchases by Russia the previous year in 1972. And then because of those prices were spiking, I think USDA probably faced some pressure to start releasing better data to help the markets manage this volatility. It seemed right at the time to start formally releasing this report to the public.
Although for the first few years, the report dealt only with U.S. crops.
Global developments were just far less important. You know, we weren't as much of an export-oriented country as we are today.
The report became global in 1980. Livestock added to the report in 82. Mark Chekanowski says the whole idea of making the WASD report public was an effort to promote transparency in agricultural markets.
And that's something that the report continues to do today.
Of course, back in the 70s, analysts were trying to do forecasting with no computers, no internet, or anything like that. Of course, today, that's completely changed.
But the basic processes of pulling in experts from across USDA are largely unchanged from 50 years ago.
And Mark says the WASD report's highly regarded in the world of agriculture. He says there are many private companies out there doing agricultural forecasting.
But ultimately, even those private sector services tend to ultimately try to predict what's going to be in the WASD.
Showing that the WASD report is looked upon with
a lot of respect and authority.
This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
How are GMO plants made? First, scientists look for a desired trait in a plant, animal, or even bacteria. It could be a trait like resistance to drought, insects, or viruses. Then they copy the gene that contains that trait and insert it into the DNA of the plant they want to improve. Scientists then grow that plant to see if it adopts the desired trait. Feed your mind with more GMO facts on FDA's website.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
Today's specialty crop news brought to you by the Almond Board of California. You can find them online at almonds.com. Bikram Hundle of Custom Almonds and Sequoia Nut Company was recently featured on the Almond Journey podcast. Hundle relates his engineering degree to the technology they're implementing on the processing side of the almond industry and how that data can ultimately help the grower be more efficient.
So the basics of processing is kind of similar, but there's a lot of new technology out there, like such as these optical sorters, and they can take pictures of any defects out there and they can just kick it out, sort it. We can do whatever we want. The technology is there. It's just the application of that technology into the almond industry. So that's what we've been doing. And we've been involving a lot of robotics and artificial intelligence in our sorting processes. So we're collecting all the data. We're making our own data silos so we can relate back to the farms, see how the quality inputs are coming in, and kind of relate that to our farm workers and farm supervisors.
Wow. Is that, I mean, does that set you all apart or is that becoming industry standard?
It is. Having our own data silos is a fairly new concept right now. It's been used in the grain industry, like wheat and rice industry. Those big giants, they have that data because there's a big old farms out there. But in case of almonds, it is catching up, I would say, but it's fairly new. The bigger entities, I'm sure they have started building their own data silos, try to collect all the data from the farms, whatever the quality inputs are getting in, what are the outputs they're getting at the processing side of things, and kind of relaying back to the farm to optimize the inputs.
No, that's really interesting. So you mentioned the optical sorting. So you've got the cameras that are actually collecting data from the visual appearance of the almonds. And so that's along the line. And then what other data goes into it? And sort of talk to us about how that kind of processing technology works.
Yes. So, like you said, we have these optical sorters. What they do is they capture real-time pictures of the almonds, and we can record how much defects are going through the sorters. And from there, we can quantify that data and relay back to which field it came from and how much is coming out, then tie back to the inputs. And we can go back, oh, this wrench was sprayed around this time, and we still saw a lot of defects, or there's a lot of foreign material coming from this wrench. What's wrong on the harvest side, or which huller it came from? We color hull this product, and we can kind of compare different hullers to from the same field. How is the foreign materials on this particular wrench compared to the product getting that we received from a different huller?
And so when you take that data back to the grower, you say, like, look, we're seeing these defects from this field. And then the grower would say, okay, well, here's what I did. And you just kind of compare notes that way?
Yes, we can compare it to him and kind of incentivize him as well. Okay, so this year you only got like only 0.5% of serious defects with you. And last year you had like 4% of serious defects. You did definitely do something right this year. Or what changes did you do? Or let's say this year he got like 4% of serious defects. And we can kind of tell him, hey, so this year insect damage is really high. So maybe you skipped some sprays, or maybe something happened. What happened? So we can go back and kind of incentivize them as well. If their quality is really good, we can tell, hey, we're willing to pay you extra percent or like extra dollar for your product because it makes our processing faster and easier, smoother. So we do not incur any losses, any production losses while we are processing it. Yes. So we do incentivize if somebody is doing good farming practices because we see that data coming through the sorter. We can tell right away how the product is. And it's 100% real-time sampling. 100% of product is being pushed, so we can collect. It's not just a random sample. So it's everything is collective. Each and every single almond we can see through is good or bad. That's the beauty of the technology right now. It's not just based on some random sampling. It's 100%.
That's interesting. I wonder if we'll get to the point where through some sort of optical sensing, we can look for, you know, like pathogens and that sort of thing, you know, where maybe you don't have to pasteurize because you've already kind of validated that they've come through and they're fine.
So there is technology out there for aflatoxins, such as if you pass the almonds or the nuts through black light, it will relay a yellow effervescence, yellow color back to it. So it can be detected. Yeah. There are some sorters that are in the market. They can kind of detect if something is infested with the aflatoxin.
And are you guys using that?
Not at the moment, but we might. It depends if we are like hit hard by those pathogens, but it all comes back to the farming side. If you're doing good job on the farming side of things, as a handler, as a processor, it's not something that we induce to the product. So that's something that we always pay attention to. We tell everybody the quality is not built at the facility, the processing side. It is at the farming side of things. Right. We do not add any insect damage. We do not add any aflatoxin. It's coming back from the field if something is coming bad.
Yeah. And where do robotics play into all this?
Yeah, so robotics play a really important role. So I would say the whole industry kind of shifted around the COVID time when we were having huge shortage of workforce. People couldn't come back to work and we had orders to supply. The demand increased and our production levels went down because we did not have enough people to work. So that's really kicked in the use of robotics, even for us too. So we invested heavily in robotics at that time and got a bunch of automated lines and these robots. They can stack and grab the product and tie that in, and which can give us real-time data of what is the throughput that we are getting at the moment. So we know at the moment, particular instant of time, how many bags we have packed or how many cartons we have packed. but which did lead to another challenge, which was educating the workforce how to run those machines as well, because people were just basic line sorters or forklift operators. They had no clue what is this. And so we started investing in getting them trainings, and so they are ready to, you know, support these automated production lines. Right. Yes, so we invested in our workforce as well. So they are trained to operate these lines, and we do a continuous trainings for them.
Great. And so does that happen internally, or do you hire a company to help do the trainings?
Yes. So our first preference is to train our workforce internally. So we give them the opportunity because they've been working with us, they've been loyal, they've been working with us forever. But of course, if we need a talent from outside, we do seek for that as well.
And for some people, I imagine that drastically changes what their day-to-day job looks like from the old way to the new way. I would hope it would be kind of an improvement for them. Or generally, do they take to it and like it?
Yes. Interesting. And I would say, so I remember, so we had women working on our line sorting, picking almonds by hand back in the days, a couple of years ago. So I told them, hey, you guys better start learning how to drive forklifts, because you guys will be the ones driving, else this job will be gone sooner or later. So at first they were a little bit reluctant, but eventually all of them started learning, and now have 100% of workforce. They're forklift trained. All the women, they are working shoulder to shoulder with men. There's no less than them. And they're operating all of our equipment, all the machines, right where they were too scared to just working on those line tables, lines, and just picking up and being those line sorters. So now they are operating the equipment, the machines, the forklifts, everything.
Again, this was just a portion of the latest Almond Journey podcast from the Almond Board of California. You can listen to more by searching Almond Journey wherever you get your podcasts.
Thanks, Brian, and stay tuned as we'll have more of the day's agriculture news and farm features here on the AgNet News Hour. Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search our name of AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet West. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
If your soil could talk, what would it say? If it's healthy, it may already be saying some good things about your future. Because farmers who use soil health building systems that include no-till, cover crops, and diverse species and rotations report greater productivity, profitability, and resiliency to weather extremes. Learn more about what your soil is saying about its health and your future. Contact your local USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service office today. This message brought to you by USDA and this radio station.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now. Vilsack urges changes in federal hiring process. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack shared with visiting National Farmers Union members his view about the federal government's hiring process.
The current hiring process within the Department of Agriculture, and for that matter within the federal government, is antiquated. It takes a long, long time to identify folks and get them through the process and get them onboarded. We've tried to streamline that process, but it is still in need of significant reform, which would require not just action by the Department of Agriculture, but action by the Office of Personnel Management. I know they're working on that. It doesn't just focus on agriculture. It would have to focus on every single department of the federal government. So you're talking about millions of people whose lives would be impacted and affected by a major reform. So it's a big deal.
With more on this topic, here's USDA's Gary Crawford.
When Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack meets with farmers, one topic producers sometimes bring up is that their local USDA offices are short-staffed and that USDA needs to hire more people. And Vilsack's response...
I'll be the first guy in the world to tell you, I'd love to have more people.
Vilsack told National Farmers Union members visiting in Washington this week that the government's hiring process needs to be easier and faster.
And we need to make our system more competitive from a compensation situation.
He said years ago the pay for field office workers was many times better than competing area jobs. Not true today. And one Missouri Farmers Union member echoed that, telling Vilsack about a short-staffed office in his county having trouble hiring and holding workers, and no wonder.
They've got Dollar General down the road that is starting them out at $21 an hour, full benefits, and giving them a supplement for if they want to continue their education.
Vilsack said despite difficulties, USDA continues to hire new workers, but he says keeping them, that's the big problem. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
USDA announces award to support One Health initiatives. USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service is awarding 36 research awards totaling more than $56 million to support One Health surveillance and coordination. One Health is a collaborative, multi-sectoral, and transdisciplinary approach working at the local, regional, national, and global levels to achieve optimal health outcomes. It recognizes the interconnection between animals, peoples, plants, and their shared environment. The announcement includes 8 agriculture and food research initiative projects from USDA's National Institute of Food and Agriculture, 1 National Science Foundation Ecology and Evolution of Infectious Disease Program projects, and 27 identified through the USDA's APHIS SARS-CoV-2 and animal funding opportunities. The award will help APHIS accomplish its goal of building an early warning system to potentially prevent or limit the next zoonotic disease outbreak. APHIS Acting Administrator Dr. Michael Watson says, quote, "This important work will strengthen our foundation to protect humans and animals for years to come." And AFB contributed to that report.
It has been a year since USDA announced the project supported through its Partnership for Climate Smart Commodities Investments.
We were pleased that the 141 projects, basically all 50 states, all major commodities, specialty crops, the whole nine yards, organic, conventional ways of production. Exciting to see the diversity of American agriculture participate in this, crop production as well as livestock and all species.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack in Wisconsin Wednesday, recognizing the anniversary and highlighting some of the first-year successes associated with the program.
Around 90% of the contracts have entered into a specific signed agreement or in the process of executing the agreement, and we've now begun the exciting opportunity of reaching out to farmers, encouraging them to participate.
With the Secretary adding resources now available to encourage farmers to participate in climate-smart practices while developing markets that would pay a premium for a climate-smart commodity. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.